The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
One of the takeaways I've had from all the conversations I've had is that there's so much work to be done in all of these different fronts, on the legal front, on the content front, on the social media approach front, on the individual responsibility front, that we're just really, really chipping away at a giant mountain. And I don't think this year is going to solve it for us. I think we're on the right track because there is progress being made. There's more research coming out. There's new things that then the companies are trying, the regulators will be trying this year. But I think we're not prepared for really basic manipulation schemes. Everybody is really concerned about synthetic media. I'm a little bit less concerned about that. But if there was a disinformation campaign around a deep fake audio or video, I think we would just be completely caught by surprise.
I'm Quinta Jurassic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, January 9th, 2020. Our Arbiters of Truth series on disinformation is back for the new year. I sat down with my co-hosts, Evelyn Dweck, Kate Klonick, and Alina Polyakova, to discuss what we've learned over the last few months of putting together this podcast, and what we should expect for the year to come. What new regulation or oversight mechanisms will we see for social media companies? Should Twitter remove or hide the president's tweets? How should we think about the unique challenges of addressing disinformation and misinformation in an election year in the United States? And just how bad are things going to get? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 493. What fresh disinformation hell awaits in 2020?
So, welcome back, everyone. This is the first new Arbiters of Truth episode in 2020. And we all thought that we had a really good time with our roundtable discussion kicking off the mini-series, that it might be a good idea to do the same thing to kick off the new year. So, I have with me Alina Polyakova in studio, and Kate Klonick and Evelyn Dweck over the magic that is Skype. And we're just going to sort of discuss what we've taken from our conversation so far and what fresh hell we should be expecting in the year to come. So to start off, yeah, Alina, what was your sort of overall takeaway from the work that we've done so far?
Yeah, thanks, Quinta. It's been a real pleasure to have an all-lady podcast focusing on tech issues, among other things, in the disinformation space. I think among all the conversations we've had, my biggest takeaway or memorable moment was from how Ben Nemo described this constant race to get ahead of the so-called bad actors in the disinformation space. That is this constant reset, and that a lot of the investigative techniques that researchers are using to track social media campaigns, disinformation campaigns, are constantly being outdated. And we're seeing that play out in real time, like weekly basis. And to my mind, that leads us to the fresh hell I expect in 2020. But I will save that for later. And my other second point is something that we've talked about a lot. I think all of us bring really different perspectives, whether it be legal perspectives, national security perspective, to this conversation. But I felt like over time, we have started to come closer to each other. And maybe that's an optimistic note, because I remember our first roundtable, we started off with Kate and I disagreeing on the meaning of the term, but also whether we should be focusing on content moderation as sort of the key arena for the future of the regulatory environment. And I think over time, I've come to a place where I see issues around privacy law, especially, and around content as also a key way to understand how we can better, as a community of democracies, develop a regulatory framework around the integrity of the information environment. And all these things have to be happening all at once. So we need to be thinking about content moderation, and we need to be thinking about how we track behavior and investigative tools, and we need to understand the intent of bad actors, and the tech sector and social media companies need to be at the table. But I think the reality is that all these things are happening at once, and they have to be happening at once for us to get out of this whack-a-mole game.
Yeah, so Kate, I'll pitch it over to you. I mean, Alina mentioned your disagreement in the first episode. Do you feel like the two of you have sort of come closer together on this?
I think that the political ads crisis that kind of happened on the platforms and the discussion around elections and disinformation and whether or not there'd be fact-checking in ads was kind of this, has been this real crisis point since we had our initial discussion. Would you say that that's accurate?
I think so. I guess I'm not sure on what part, how much of a crisis it's been, but it's certainly been a pivotal moment in the conversation.
I mean, that's true. It might not have been a crisis, but I do feel like it was a crisis at the platforms. So I guess maybe that's kind of the level that I'm talking about. But I would say that that's made me kind of, I don't know, it's both given me more nuance in how you specifically solve these types of problems of disinformation for elections. And by that, I mean, how effective or practical it is to expect there to be fact-checking boards or fact-checking agencies for information versus other types of things that we can do to solve for disinformation, which are more like doing geo-ad blocking for political ads and content moderation in the weeks before an election versus micro-targeting or blocking micro-targeting. I think that all of that I still kind of believe that disinformation is not necessarily the problem so much as deciding how to control for the spread of disinformation and to keep it from influencing elections in a negative way and in an undemocratic way that we don't have time to build into kind of our human decision-making before we have to go to the voting booth.
Right. So I guess we can agree that disinformation will always be here for us. But the question that we are continuing to struggle with is that distribution mechanisms and how do we deal with the amplification of bad information? What's the responsibility of individuals in sharing that kind of bad information or disinformation and all of the various actors involved?
So, Evelyn, I'll kick it over to you. What's your position on that?
I really want to sort of lean in on Alina's second big takeaway. It was one of mine as well. The need for interdisciplinarity here is just huge. You know, these are multifaceted problems that involve like law, both domestic and international relations, technical and engineering knowledge, human rights problems, journalism, privacy, on and on and on. So, you know, we really need to learn to walk and chew gum and juggle and ride a unicycle all at the same time here. Otherwise, it's sort of, we're not going to be able to sort of tackle this problem. If you only focus on one aspect, you're definitely missing the big picture and how it's actually operating in practice. And that sort of, I guess, ties into her first big takeaway as well, that because this is evolving, if we don't have that interdisciplinarity, you know, people over in an echo bubble, the lawyers over in an echo chamber themselves solving one particular problem are going to miss what the new problem is. And I guess my second big takeaway is the global nature of these issues, which I guess, you know, my accent kind of betrays my priors here. But, you know, these are kind of wicked problems within any individual country, which is, you know, the conversation that we were just having then. It's really difficult to know what to do with political ads or disinformation, even within the borders of one particular political debate. And then if you open that up, as some of our guests really encouraged us to do and forced us to do, David Kaye in particular, you know, if you're thinking about how this dynamic plays out in different countries, you really need to be thinking more globally about how the rules that you make or the norms that you start to develop in any one country, how they might play out differently in different contexts.
So, Quinta, what do you think? What have been your big takeaways?
I think my big takeaway is honestly how much variation there has been in the big takeaways. You know, across the various guests that we've had come on and even among ourselves right now, there's such a range in terms of how people are thinking about this problem, in terms of how we can address it or if we can address it, really ranging from kind of cautious optimism, you know, we're facing a crisis, but we've faced crises before, it's different in character, but, you know, we'll tackle it, to just profound pessimism. And I find that really interesting. I do think that when Americans, and I'm speaking parochially here, Evelyn, started thinking seriously about disinformation post 2016, there was this kind of sense of, oh my God, the world has completely changed. How are we ever going to deal with this? And now that we're, you know, we've come to 2020, there's both a acceptance, I think, among, at least in the American political environment, that disinformation and misinformation are, they're here. We're going to need to deal with them. On the one hand, you know, they're sort of part of everyday life at this point, right? And on the other hand, there is this sort of sense of, you know, we're stuck in this unending dystopia from which there is no escape. So the range of how people are thinking about this is really striking. And I confess I've struggled about this in my own thinking on the question of whether this just feels particularly dire because we're living through it right now, or whether it really is something that is so characterologically different from anything we've seen before.
Yeah, I think you're right, Quinta, in terms of we're living through this moment where there's still a huge amount of gray area, and the problem is developing. The solutions are lagging, I think, still, and we're still struggling to understand what this is and what it isn't. But I also think that's also makes this intellectually exciting, if not exciting in reality, because of all the different ways in which our digital space can be manipulated and undermined for malicious gain, if you want to put it that way.
I actually think this is so interesting because I've been thinking very hard about the substantive problem of like deciding whether something is true or false or what constitutes disinformation and how you do that at scale. And then I think a lot about how this is a historic problem and that we've seen it over and over again, and that why does it feel so different now? And I think that the why, as I said before, the why does it feel so different now is much more the problem than the disinformation. So like that's like me, I think that I've stated that before, but that's not to say that I don't think that we should try to get to the bottom of truth. But I do think that there is only a certain amount that trying to get to the bottom of truth is going to bring us. I have like a very interesting hypo that I saw play out over Christmas, and I kind of was interested in what the group thought of it, which was, I don't know if people saw this, but there was a video that was circulating that was of, it was shot in France, apparently, because it was all in French. And it was of a father and his son was unwrapping a present. And it said, it was a book, and it was Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. And the father picks up the book and turns to his father, who's the grandfather of the boy, and goes, "Oh my gosh, I said Minecraft, not Mein Kampf." Minecraft, Papa. And like the grandfather is just like completely like has no idea what Minecraft is, obviously. And it's just like, you know, and then the video cuts out. And this went around like kind of virally on like Twitter during like the holidays and whatever. And of course it ends up being completely fake. And when I say fake, it's not fake. And it's like, it is fake and it's not fake. It was a staged thing done by a French comedian that got disambiguated from the French comedian's website. So like it was just completely stripped of identifying factors and went around as if it was like a completely original, like kind of spur of the moment event that was just going viral. And you didn't hear a lot of complaints about fake news about it because obviously the stakes are rather low and it was just like kind of a joke and people found it funny. But I kind of think that it was like an interesting moment of all of us being a little bit tricked by fake news, but like no one being apoplectic about it. And I kind of want to know what people think a platform should do with something like that. If there is, or like what that potentially poses as a danger to society, and how you delineate between something that's a joke, but real, like a real joke that someone really made, versus like something that is supposed to be staged as a real event.
I think that's a fascinating example. And I had not seen the video because I have tried not to be on the internet over the holidays. But I think it brings up this interesting view that I've heard some representatives of the big platforms talk about, which is their thoughts on providing context to content versus taking things down when they're in that ambiguous zone, when it's not clearly linked or can be attributed to a specific, let's say, state actor or other kind of actor who is trying to push forward an inauthentic coordinated campaign. And YouTube has started experimenting with this a little bit. Well, they will, you know, put a label, for example, on an RT video and say RT is a state-sponsored media outlet for the Russian government. And they started to do more of this. Well, they will put a label on other kinds of content to link it to like a Wikipedia page or to another independent source to let people know where this is coming from so they can learn more about it. And I think this was also something that was interestingly included in Twitter's new synthetic media policy. They had a period before the break where they opened up for comment. And one of the ideas they listed, whether that would become policy or not, I'm not sure, was that kind of context provision that Twitter would be looking into for exactly this kind of content that's maybe manipulated, maybe it's a deep fake, maybe it's fake in different ways that we can define it. And I think that's a really interesting way forward. I think what we just don't know is what works, right? And again, that's the point I keep coming back to, is that, you know, we're still in such early stages and there's not so much evidence-based research on what actually works to stop the spread of disinformation.
Yeah, I think I really like those kinds of initiatives as well around providing more context and doing things that really take us out of this take down, leave up paradigm of binary choice that we so often seem to get forced into these conversations. I think one of the real sort of benefits of our new information space, it's not all dystopic and terrible. The internet and these companies provide a lot more affordances than we generally have in historically thought about in terms of censorship. It's not just like, can this be published or not? You can do a lot more sort of with the technical tools to provide context or, you know, change circulation patterns, et cetera, that I am really excited to see more thinking around. And one of the, you know, the question then is always like, can it scale? And it's like, well, if a particular video goes particularly viral, then that's when you can sort of maybe start employing all of those tools. Because I mean, if we were to try and provide more context for every satirical joke on any of these platforms, it would obviously become unmanageable within the first second, literally. So yeah, I think that that's a good way forward. And something that I think about, I mean, it's such a great example. Something that I think about a lot is we need to be thinking a little bit more at a sort of higher level of generality of what is the point of tackling disinformation on these platforms. And I don't think, to me, it's not like we need to make sure that people have the truth. I think that one of the things that we're trying to do when we're tackling disinformation, because we can't decide what is the truth, what we're trying to actually do is increase trust in the information ecosystem, which is currently, you know, going through a bit of a legitimacy crisis. And I don't think you get that higher level goal by having platforms becoming too heavy-handed in determining what is or is not true and what can be said.
Evelyn, riffing on your point about the different ways that platforms can work on the spectrum, as you say, from take down to leave up and sort of find a middle place in there. There's an example that's happened just recently that you and I have spoken about, which has to do with what else than the president's Twitter account. And this is less about disinformation and more about content moderation policies. But people who have been following U.S. policy toward Iran over the last couple of weeks probably know that President Trump has been tweeting a lot. And some of the things that he is tweeting arguably violate Twitter's terms of service. Specifically, he's called for, I think, what can fairly and accurately be characterized as a wide variety of war crimes, from bombing Iranian cultural sites to responding disproportionately to Iranian attacks. And this spurred a lot of people. Every time he does one of those tweets, a lot of people will tweet at Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, and say, Jack Dorsey, why is this content still on Twitter? And there is actually a reason for that, right? Which is that Twitter now has a policy that if there is a tweet that is of public interest, it will remain on the platform, even if it might otherwise be taken down as violating the terms of service. But in some cases, they might sort of put that tweet behind like a click-through window, so you have to affirmatively choose to look at it. And then there's this question of, you know, well, why didn't Twitter decide that, you know, a tweet advocating war crimes goes behind that window? And I think that that gets to both the possibilities that exist within that spectrum from take down to leave up, but also, and Evelyn, you hinted at this, just how incredibly difficult it is for platforms to make these decisions in tense environments.
So just to follow up on that, Quinta, I think that exactly elaborates why we need a public policy regulatory component to this. And there's been a really big debate developing in Washington, also in Europe, especially as the European Commission has made digital policy one of their sort of key core initiatives under the new commissioner, to see how a regulatory agency, whether it be an independent body, which is the big debate, should we have an independent regulator set up that's akin to the FCC, for example, or something similar? Will the Europeans go that way? It seems that they want to, which will, I think, dramatically shift the nature of the game. And there needs to be some guidance, I think, provided to the companies to say, what is the public interest? How do we define the public interest, right? How should we approach political advertising ahead of elections? Should there be a blackout period 10 days before, 5 days before, 3 months before, right? I think it should be the governments in democratic societies that provide that kind of regulatory guidance and that kind of legal responsibility to the companies, because I don't think I want, you know, Facebook or Twitter or anyone deciding what their blackout period is going to be around an election. I think that should be up to our regulatory agencies. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see, and maybe this is a segue to our Fresh Hell segment. It'll be really interesting to see what happens, especially at the European level, as Europeans have been setting the regulatory agenda in a real way, in a way the U.S. has kind of taken a back seat to it, what happens next, and whether we will get some sort of independent regulator, whether it be in the U.K. or in Brussels.
So, I mean, I think it's an interesting problem, the what should Twitter do with Trump's tweets. I have a minority view on this. I'm not quite sure what the impetus behind the tweeting at Jack Dorsey is. Like, is the idea that Iran would just forget about Trump's threats if Twitter took those tweets down? Because I don't actually think that that would necessarily be the case. And I couldn't agree with you more, Alina, that I don't think Twitter should be deciding what is public interest or what public leaders should be saying. Personally, I think that we need to be able to hold leaders accountable for what they say and do. And one way in which we do that is by actually seeing what they say and do. And I don't like the idea of some sort of prior censorship where Twitter takes things down without the public seeing them. And I think that once they're out there, there's sort of limited utility in Twitter completely removing it. Although, like I said, and like you raised, Quinta, there are other tools that you can do, like putting them behind a warning screen or reducing the ability for them to go so viral would be useful. But, you know, fundamentally, I think that if you don't like Trump's tweets, your problem is with the Trump part of that problem and not the tweeting part of the problem. But, you know, that, like I said, a minority view. So, yes.
I just want to say that I agree with Evelyn completely about Trump's tweets, but I would also extend that that to fake news, which I think is basically like, if your problem is fake news, your problem is with fake news and not necessarily the platform that the fake news is appearing on.
Yeah, that's something I've been thinking about as well, that so much of what people complain about, get angry about when it comes to platform governance issues are often really just ways of sort of channeling some other deep frustration, right? So whether that be anxiety about what truth is and means in an age of hyperpolarization in the American context, or perhaps discomfort and anger with a presidency or certain policies, that all that kind of gets channeled into this desire for, you know, Jack Dorsey to come in and somehow magically fix everything, right, by taking down a tweet.
To tag on to that, I think that there is something that's happening here that is that we're kind of seeing this right now. There was an article on Airbnb recently that kind of covered a lot of how Airbnb settles things and how they deal with, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, and how it deals with various types of property torts and other types of torts from both hosts and guests and criminal activity. And I went through this in like kind of a Twitter thread, but I think it's actually kind of, it tags onto your post, and I don't want to take time away from the hellfire segment. But just to briefly say, yeah, I think that we're kind of maybe in a moment of reckoning with that, even though these platforms are huge and have brought us together and been the glue that kind of forces us to see all of these things, that we're maybe at a place where we're finally recognizing the fact that, like, just because Airbnb like lists our house and plugs us in with someone doesn't mean that they should be responsible for every bad thing that happens to us. If you decide to stay in an Airbnb and things go terribly wrong, there are some things that are just not foreseeable. And there are some things that are, to be fair. Like, there are some things that definitely are. And they might be the least cost avoider. But I just think that there's a wide range of answers to that question. I think we're in the process of sorting it out. And I think that, like, this last year has just been an insane sorting process, I think, with people becoming much more sophisticated around all of these issues.
So now that, you know, we have that sophistication under our belts, what do you all think is coming up in 2020? Are we culturally better positioned to tackle whatever it is that we're going to have to tackle?
Well, I would say no. Mainly because despite my desire to be optimistic, one of the takeaways I've had from all the conversations I've had is that there's so much work to be done in all of these different fronts, on the legal front, on the content front, on the social media approach front, on the individual responsibility front, that we're just really, really chipping away at a giant mountain. And I don't think this year is going to solve it for us. I think we're on the right track because there is progress being made. There's more research coming out. There's new things that the companies are trying, the regulators will be trying this year. But I think we're not prepared for really basic manipulation schemes. Everybody is really concerned about synthetic media. I'm a little bit less concerned about that. But if there was a disinformation campaign around a deep fake audio or video, I think we would just be completely caught by surprise, even though we've all been talking about it. And that's exactly because there hasn't really been kind of a sense of agreement across the platforms or sense of agreement even between governments and platforms. And there's still just a profound lack of trust between the companies and governments and researchers. And we see that over and over again in terms of how companies do or do not share information, for example, with researchers. So I think 2020 obviously is going to be a huge test. But at the same time, I think focusing on the elections, I hope that after 2020 is over and hopefully goes smoothly, that, you know, the companies don't just take a big sigh and say, okay, now we can just like let it loose and we're all good and we solve the problem. Because as we were saying earlier, this problem is not going to get solved, even if one election goes off smoothly.
I also want to go in the no column for have we solved this? I'm a little bit discouraged by how little progress has been made since 2016. There has been a lot of hand-wringing, including by everyone currently on this podcast, but I don't know how much that's resulted in like substantive progress on the policies and issues. But I really wanted to pick up on something that Alina said that I think is really important, is that one of the big things that we hoped coming out of the sort of disaster around 2016 or the moment of awareness raising around 2016 was that there might be further research into what actually happened. I mean, we still don't even know how big of a problem this is and how much of it is just hysteria. And one of the promising moments is that for the first time ever, we kind of have more data about speech and persuasion and, you know, communication patterns than has ever existed before, but it's all locked up. And so on that note, I think one of the really discouraging things that has happened in the last few years and in the last few months in particular has been the falling through of some of the relationships between Facebook in particular and groups of researchers to get some of that data out to do more empirical work on what's actually going on, because I really think that our policy responses are going to be pretty ill-informed and perhaps counterproductive without knowing exactly what the problem is and the shape of it. And so that's my big sort of disappointment of the last few years and heading into 2020.
Kate?
Yeah, I think that the thing that I would, and just to turn pivot a little bit, I agree with everything that was said. And then I also would just say that I think that, I mean, maybe this is obvious to you guys, as you guys know what I've been working on, but I think that my 2020 is literally all about the oversight board that Facebook is launching and thinking about what's happening there and its implications on freedom of expression. I am really apprehensive about how it's going to be received globally. And I mean, I don't mean apprehensive because I have a stake in like how it ends up, but because I just really am curious, because I've spent so much time being very close to it. I'm just very curious at how other people think these decisions have been made and whether they think that they have been the right decisions. And we've seen, I mean, like Evelyn has been doing incredible scholarship. There's a lot of interesting conclusions that they've come to after like global consultancy. It's a question of whether the trend, I think, going forward in 2020 is going to turn towards a democratization / multi-stakeholderism / outsourcing / oversight board, third party, someone else's problem trends by platforms, or whether it's going to turn towards regulation, and how in the midst of all of this, platforms and governments are going to deal with disinformation, which is, to be fair, one of the harder problems to manage on content moderation platform, like in the content moderation ecosystem of platforms. So I think that that's kind of what I'm thinking about. But I agree with everything else that was said here. I think that those are all huge issues. I'm just kind of very platform focused at the moment.
So the mentioning the Facebook oversight board, I think, goes back to the point that Alina was making earlier about having some kind of external oversight. If what we've seen in the past couple of years is sort of platforms struggling to work through these problems and the public and scholars and practitioners struggling to think about responsibility, is 2020 the year when we start to actually implement sort of external oversight models? Is the Facebook oversight board part of a trend possibly there?
Well, my concern with the approach to the board, if that becomes a trend, at least for the companies to follow, not just Facebook, is that I still think it's really such a small part of the problem. And it's quite heavily content focused. And to my mind, again, this comes down to the fact that yes, content is important, but what's more important is the distribution systems behind it, in which specific pieces of content are sort of an indicator of a broader set of behaviors and how information spreads online. And I think the reason why I say that is a point that you, I think, made earlier, Quinta, that this is really an ecosystem. And what happens on Facebook doesn't stay on Facebook, right? It's not Las Vegas, or the other way around. And there is a whole set of other platforms. Many of them are coming out of authoritarian regimes, most notably China. I mean, TikTok, I'll just mention. I don't understand TikTok. I will age myself when I say that. But we're going to see more and more platforms like this emerge that go viral in terms of use. And we have zero ability to regulate or look inside what's happening in a way that we still do with the Western or U.S.-based companies. And so to my mind, I think there's just a much bigger set of issues here. And I will hope that at some point in 2020, and maybe the election will be a galvanizing moment for that, for the companies to say, hey, like, we really need to do this together because, you know, there are so many entryways. And we're getting to a point where competition is becoming so intense with other potential platforms that are not democratic that we need to come together. That would be, I suppose, my more optimistic take, that maybe the election will be a watershed moment that will teach us some lessons about how we should all play nice together to get ahead of this. But again, I remain a little skeptical about that.
I will rain on Elena's optimistic take and say, I think that we thought that's what 2016 was going to be.
Oh, I never thought that.
Moment of galvanization, and it didn't come through. So, I mean, maybe it's just going to be so bad in 2020 that it will actually be that moment.
So I think one of my fresh hell visions really emerged with the Tiffany Lee podcast that we did on kind of how data use and the interlocking with privacy law, lack of privacy law, and how that kind of provides ample fertile ground for disinformation or information manipulation, and the kind of future that could engender if we don't actually do anything about it. And I think often, you know, I've been writing and thinking a lot about this idea of digital authoritarianism, which is, of course, something that China is really leading the way on. But in recent months, we've had all of this reporting, especially from the New York Times, about surveillance capitalism and the extent to which private companies, not just social media companies, obviously, but every single app that's basically on your phone and far beyond that, are tracking us in all these various ways. And I think that, to me, is much more terrifying to think about. And it really suggests a profound lack of consumer awareness. Or care. I don't think most people care that much, like, given their privacy. They kind of assume that this is the new world that we're living in. But that, to me, the surveillance state, whether it be a capitalist surveillance state or authoritarian surveillance state, is just really, really terrifying.
Yeah, that moment in the Tiffany Lee podcast, I have to agree with you, Alina, was pretty scary. And just this sort of intersection between, like, our desire for truth in this moment, trying to find something to hold on to, and how that, you know, can potentially intersect with privacy and sort of make everything on the table in terms of having to verify everything. And it just reminds me of, like, my absolute favorite book from 2019. So maybe we can finish this with a book recommendation, like all good podcasts tend to do. Is Ted Chiang's short story collection, Exhalation. But there's a particular story in there called The Truth of Fact and The Truth of Feeling. And I'm not going to spoil it, but it really does, to me, get to the question of what do we lose or gain when technology replaces memory and when everything becomes verifiable. So I'm going to put a shout out for that book here.
All right. So I think let's leave it there on Evelyn's book recommendation. But before I wrap up, Alina has some exciting news.
I do indeed, my fellow arbiters of truth. So I just wanted to share that I will still be arbitering truth in the context of this podcast, but it will be with a new hat. sadly, but also somewhat happily, I'm leaving Brookings to head a think tank based in Washington, D.C. called the Center for European Policy Analysis, where I will continue working on all things digital as well, but in a slightly different, you could say surveillance hat, if you will, as president and CEO. And so I just wanted to share that news because it's already out there in the Twitter sphere.
Yeah, so we're sad to be losing your Brookings, but delighted to be keeping you in your truth arbitering capacity. Well, thank you guys for coming around for another roundtable in three different time zones. We will leave it there.
You've been listening to the 8th episode of Arbiters of Truth, the Lawfare Podcast's mini-series on disinformation. You can find past episodes in the Lawfare Podcast feed. We'll be back with another episode next Thursday. The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Our audio engineer was Michaela Fogel, and our producer is Jen Patia Howell. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast on the podcasting app of your choice. And as always, thanks for listening.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.